Okay, Dr. Gibbons, what I have on the, as folks who are on, is yourself, Dr. Prager, Dr. Sadawi, and Dr. Spindler are here. Are any of the other committee members join us? Well, I'm expecting Dr. Crouch and Dr. Katzen, so I'm hoping they'll be able to join us shortly.
Reva, this is Sarah. I need to leave at 4.
Okay, great.
Time,
All right. So. Thanks, Sarah. But I think, Ted, we should go ahead and get started with the presentation from Francois.
Sure, that sounds great. So we're discussing two measures today, each of which are put in the context with Dr. With Francois about the use of preventable, potential avoidable complications, first for AMI and then for stroke, and we're eager to hear about the context in which this measure was developed.
Right. I think that's your cue, Francois.
Great.
And he has a set of slides that I sent you earlier and are also being put up on the webinar.
And great. Thank you, Reva, and thank you for the introduction. So I will be tremendously brief so that we can get to the more substantive Q&A. The context within which, on the next slide, the context within which this particular set of definitions around complications of care were developed was part of the development of the Prometheus payment model, which has been completely funded by foundations such as the ones listed on this slide. The model itself builds on a unique definition of episodes, which we refer to as evidence-informed case rates. And in building these evidence-informed case rates, next slide, we really tried to look at a number of things. So first of all, can we define an episode that is meaningful clinically, can be severity adjusted at the individual patient level, and also creates a number of inherent incentives, one of which is clinical collaboration across the care continuum, so irrespective of site of care, and really focused on the patient as a whole, not just tightly linked to a condition, a procedure, or an acute medical event such as an MI. So the episodes themselves include all services, they're time delimited, and as we've tried to create responsibility for management of patients within the context of an episode of care, we focused on this issue of trying to differentiate as best we could in claims data. Typical services or services that are routinely delivered to patients from those that can be attributed to potentially avoidable complications, as you mentioned earlier. And on this slide, I underline and bold and italicize potentially because when talking to physicians about these potentially avoidable complications, very often this term, which was chosen for very specific reasons, has a tendency to get sidestepped. And potentially in the normal language doesn't mean absolutely avoidable. It means some of these may happen, but many can, in fact, or should be avoided. So the goal is not to get to zero defects. The goal is to get to, you know, a certain identifiable number as low as possible. So what is an episode for acute inpatient events? It's really 30 days, so we look at the beginning of the episode being triggered by the index hospitalization and then the end 30 days after that, post-discharge, so after the stay. And as we look at claims, we really try to differentiate, again, the ones that can be associated to typical care versus potentially avoidable complications. And the stuff in red here on this slide is attributable to potentially avoidable complications. Readmissions is a good example, whereas the blue is associated to typical services. Within an index hospitalization, and as I'm sure you're all familiar with and sensitive to, When you get a discharge claim from a hospital for payment purposes, there's a whole bunch of things listed. And so within an index hospitalization, there might be line items in that claim that represent potentially avoidable complications, site infections, falls, DVTs, et cetera, as well as, of course, all the other services routinely associated to that index hospitalization. Which is why in our definition of potentially avoidable complications as submitted to the NQF for endorsement, we're looking at these as discrete events that occur, and that can, in fact, be counted as part of an overall a claim stream as it develops during the episode of care. So potentially avoidable complications are sorted essentially through a mechanism of filters. And this is just a pictorial example of lots of claims coming in for an episode and then being parsed into things that clearly are excluded from that episode, included into the bucket that we refer to as potentially avoidable complications, or all the rest of the stuff that goes into typical care. And again, here we in this effort, although in an episode of care effort, we're looking at dollars. Here we're really not looking at dollars. We're looking at unique, discrete events, line items, and claims that indicate the presence of a potentially avoidable complication. Next slide. All right, so we've defined basically three categories of these potentially avoidable complications. Those that are associated to the index condition or admission, in this case MI or stroke. Those that can be associated more to comorbid conditions. And the third that could be associated to, broadly speaking, patient safety failures. Now, one important point at this junction, because it came up last week when we were on the technical advisory panel of infectious disease for the complications of care associated to pneumonia, is the issue of present on admission. And I heard you say that you've read through the, and I applaud you for having read through that submission a number of times. We do specify that potentially avoidable complications are counted as they present themselves in claims, but an exclusion criteria would be those complications that are present on admission. So in the examples that we show and in the data that we present to the NQF as part of the endorsement process, we did not have access to any claims with POA indicators. So some of the information that we present, again, comes from our own analyses, does not have exclusions based on present on admission criteria simply because we did not have access to those data. But we do specify that if a patient comes in for an MI and already has pneumonia and that's present on admission, obviously we're not going to count it as a potentially avoidable complication associated to the hospitalization. Next slide. So just, and this is a very broad brush because there's, as you know, a fair amount of supporting data in the two separate applications. But as you count number of potentially avoidable complications and you look at them between MI and stroke, the vast majority of complications associated with potentially avoidable complication readmissions are really for MIs, repeat MIs, or other cardiac problems post-discharge. And then about 70% of the PACs during the index stay are a combination of type 2, so associated to comorbid conditions, or type 3, associated to patient safety issues. And so we realize that at least for the index stay portion of MI and stroke, the total amount or number of potentially avoidable complications associated to the treatment of the MI itself is relatively low. But again, in our definition of potentially avoidable complications and how we're looking at this comprehensive complication of care measure, it really is from the eyes of the patient looking out throughout the healthcare system during the continuum of the episode and associated to the patient and the patient's comorbid conditions, whole patient, as opposed to just the tight discrete event. And I say this again because I do know that this is the part of this particular measure that makes most physicians quite uncomfortable, but it is done for very specific reasons because we don't think there are measures in the market today that address this issue, and that's what we're trying to do through these submissions.
I got a question. This is Tony Sidawi, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure.
The data that you're going to collect up to 30 days, are you going to collect it from where? Because to my knowledge, if you're going to collect it from Medicare data, that's usually only hospital stay, and it's not up to 30 days.
Well, again, the way the calculations of these potentially avoidable complications are done is looking at the entire data stream for the 30 days for the index hospitalization and the 30 days post discharge across the continuum. So it's not it's not tightly defined as the stay portion of the MI, but it's the stay portion of the MI plus all associated professional services plus all professional services post-discharge for 30 days associated to the patient's care.
So if a patient leaves the hospital in 7 days and then get a complication and go to the doctor's office for the complication, that will be picked up as well?
And
not getting
right.
admitted again, that will be picked up as well?
That will be picked up, yes.
Okay.
Well,
through charges to Medicare from the physician's office.
I think that perhaps we need to go step by step through the measure because, as defined, based on the description of the measure, this is examining MI and at least MI from the ages 18 to 65, and it's not a Medicare-specific claims database.
First, you look at CMS, which is the most probably organized or available data, I think probably getting from private insurance record or even people who are not even insured, that's going to be even more difficult.
Right. I think that question, that emphasis is something that we'll want to get into in more detail when we go through the measure
okay.
itself. That actually comprises at least 50% of the questions and comments that I had about the measure and its application to different populations.
Okay, thanks.
So thank you, Dr. DeBrunt. Then, Viva, do you think it's appropriate to start going through the measure?
Sure. That'd be great. I mean, you guys are the most experienced CAP members I've got.
Okay.
So many times. Feel
right.
Safe.
So just as a clarification, because I think it is important. I am not a doctor. I'm not a clinician, and so the lead physician who has helped in the development of this effort is actually away on a serious family issue and so could not be present during this call. I have been an active involved participant in the development of all of this. So while I am intimately familiar with its details, because I'm not a clinician, I will not be able to answer questions that relate to the clinical relevance of some of these.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think that's very fair, and we appreciate your being able to join us today. When we review each measure, as every member of the TAP member committee knows, we go through the categories of subcriteria that have been defined by NQF and need to grade each of these subcriteria. But first, just to describe the measure is the proportion of patients hospitalized with AMI that have a potentially avoidable complication during the index stay or the 30-day post-discharge period. So again, this is applied, as I just mentioned, to the percent of the adult population aged 18 to 65 years admitted to a hospital with acute MI followed for 1 month after discharge with PACs that have been defined as the description in the separate document has shown through matching this with both CMS and AHRQ quality measures and complications. So the documentation of the potentially avoidable complications are in six categories, three within the hospitalization and three in the 30-day post-discharge period, which, as Dr. DeBrunt just emphasized, were related to, one, the anchor condition, two, comorbidities, or three, patient safety failures. And that's repeated in the post-discharge period. I guess it is clearly defined. I guess one question that will come up, so we might as well try to answer it straight off, is this defining an AMI as the principal diagnosis for which the patient sought medical care, and does that exclude AMIs that occur as a consequence or within the hospitalization but not the primary diagnosis?
Yes, the latter. Yes. So, because it's a dual statement. So, yes, this is for patients who are admitted to the hospital with a principal diagnosis of MI, and it excludes patients who are in the hospital for another diagnosis and who might have an MI. In fact, for the latter, we would consider the MI a potentially avoidable complication on their original hospitalization.
So, if they pneumonia, then the MI would be a PAC for the pneumonia.
That's exactly right.
Right. Okay. So since this is based on a database from commercially insured population, are the people who are going to be analyzed for this those who are within commercially insured populations only?
We are submitting the measure as defined for populations under the age of 65 because those are the data that we have access
right.
to and that we're looking at. That is not to say that this measure would not be applicable to populations over the age of 65. In fact, we think it could, but because we have no data and we have not analyzed any Medicare data, apart from a little bit of Medicare Advantage data, we were not in a position to add that to the submission at this point.
So does this also include PACs in individuals under the age of 65 who are covered by DSHS or have no insurance?
No. So what we're presenting is only for patients who are commercially insured, which now, with health reform, if it gets implemented, ought over time to cover the majority of the population.
Okay, so that's very nice to know. It would be actually very valuable for the measure to actually make that statement up front.
Yeah, this is Riva. Just a comment. This topic has come up when NQF has looked at other measures that are based solely on claims data because,
uh-huh.
again, you don't have a claim stream from these other populations, and it is, you know, just one of the limitations of using claims.
Correct. But I do think that for the purpose of the steering committee and any other readers, that the measure actually make it clear that population is narrowed down because the exclusions that we get to don't actually mention that.
Okay.
So going further down to the second page, the measure description, brief description is quite clear. The conditions, importance to measure and report. I think that the description has been very nicely put forth and obviously captures a younger population in whom the patient-centered approach is going to be valuable both for the payer as well as the patient, him or herself. So I think that the importance to measure and report is clear. I gave that a C. Summary of evidence of high impact, I gave a C. The next 1B, opportunity for improvement, that's clearly been demonstrated. I gave that a C for complete. 1C, outcome or evidence to support the measure focus, certainly from the patient standpoint as well as including the fact that comorbidities must be paid attention to in the global care of a patient and follow-up I think that the evidence is there to support the measure focus. The interpretation will be interesting over time, so I give that a C.
Great. So that's the three categories for importance. Does anybody else on the committee quibble with Dr. Hibben's ratings?
No.
Okay, good. So moving on to the I hope I don't get a migraine from that movement. The scientific acceptability. So measure specifications, precisely specified. Well, I think it's very nicely specified, and the database as well as the description of the process that the Prometheus group went through to get feedback from clinicians and from large medical groups was quite commendable and well described. So it's precisely specified for this population with the exclusions that we just mentioned about the populations that will not be studied who don't have commercial insurance. So I gave 2A a C. And then moving on to 2B. Could be as reliability testing. This, again, I had questions about this initially because I wondered about the populations to which this might be applied, but since the process is actually very nicely described in the supplementary document, the reliability testing, I believe, has been demonstrated. I gave 2B a C as well. Validity testing, I gave a C to with now my understanding about the populations applied to which this is applied. The exclusions, as I mentioned before, I think it would be useful within here to explicitly state that exclusions will be for anyone over the age of 65 and under 18, anyone who is not commercially insured, specifically patients who are on Medicaid.
Right.
But the exclusions, I think, are nicely described, as well as to make sure that we mention as well that patients admitted for another diagnosis who have an AMI are also excluded if it's a secondary diagnosis. I think that would actually harmonize very well with other AMI and coronary disease measures that NQF has looked at. But with those provisions, I think 2D obviously would get a C. So moving on from there to... Did we skip one? 2E, risk adjustment. The risk adjustment is reasonably well described. I think that the risk adjustment will have to be looked at over time to be sure that as other populations are included, particularly as healthcare reform progresses, hopefully faster than it looks right now, that the risk adjustment model may need to include other data that arise as a result of larger populations being included into the CIP database. Is that an actual plan of the project, Dr. DeBrath?
Yes.
Yep, good. Okay. So the risk adjustment with those provisions I would give a C to as well.
And Dr. Gibbons, just so you know, we're also having our bias statistician review these measures.
Dr. O'Brien, good. Yeah,
yeah, great. Because it is fairly detailed and technical stuff.
Right. 2F, identification of meaningful differences in performance. I gave this a C, but I was concerned that although we have the potential to show differences in performance, I wasn't quite clear from all the data that was presented that is actually something that we can tell from in the AMI diagnosis. And the reason I say that is in that accompanying description of the development of the PACs, Dr. Mm-hmm. DeBrant, mm-hmm. You have a nice histogram of the excessive expenses for each state in the case of diabetes.
Right.
Going from a low in the western states, I'm glad to say that I'm a citizen of the western states, and then going out to the eastern states, or at least to the higher PAC expenditures. But it would be nice for us to, if it's possible, to actually see the same type of histogram for AMI, if that exists.
Yes, it does, and we will make it available to the TAP.
Right, and also for stroke, too, because I'm sure that'll come up, too. So that I guess with the our interest, or my interest in actually seeing that histogram, I think our ability to understanding the meaningful differences in performance, at least state by state, would be there. And I assume that the reporting will be in some qualitative measure as well as quantitative, such as a 1 to 5 star rating. Or how do you propose to report the results of this?
Great question. The accountability part of the reporting is really designed not to do strict comparative reporting of facilities more than to do, we think of this more as a quality improvement measure in the sense that you start at a certain level and you ought to be able to decrease, although clearly there can be, and it can be used for cross-facility comparisons. Because we don't really know what best, and nor can we at this point gauge who would be best in breed, which is what we would need in order to create a 5-star rating. Any rating based on stars would end up by being relatively subjective. So I think we stop short of recommending any specific mode for using the measure more than to define conditions under which it can be used for accountability purposes.
Right.
And I know I'm being vague, because what we're trying to do is not to artificially say this is the best guy or this is the worst guy, because we just don't know the answer to that question, more than to say there is variation. Someone's coming in at a 75%, and so let's look, you know, next year as to whether they can come in at a 70% or a 65%. And if a facility has a PAC rate of 75% and another one has an 80%, it's not clear that 5% is significantly different, because the frequency or the specific type of PAC can be very different. So you might have an 80% rating, but the majority of your PACs are, you know, relatively minor, or you might have a, you know, 75%, but some of them are relatively major. So we haven't gotten to the point where we feel comfortable saying assign a star rating to something like this, because we just don't know enough about we don't think that that's appropriate at this point.
Right, but then it sort of begs the question about how this becomes an outcome measure if the measure that is the outcome is not graded in terms of either qualitative or quantitative measure. And the other thing is that the subtext of the Prometheus project, as admirable as it is money. And so when the histogram reports excessive expenditures based on PACs, the interpretation may be that more expensive care is less good care. I think there's an argument to be made for that, but nonetheless, the interpretation of caregivers in the population may be confused by just presenting financial data.
I agree. I mean, I think this is the dilemma of any measure developer, because there are lots of measures that have been developed and that are being used today in ways that weren't necessarily conceived of or even approved by the measure developers. And I think that's a risk that we all take when a measure goes through endorsement and becomes used. For our purposes, the way we use PACs, as you indicate, is tied to monetary incentives. And the reality is that the fewer PACs you have, the greater your margin per patient. So there's actually a pretty high incentive for facilities and physicians to work together to reduce them. That's our application. I mean, I can say the same thing for blood pressure control. I haven't yet seen lots of people do star rankings on blood pressure control, and yet I guess nothing really stops them from doing it if they wanted to.
Right. Okay, I still think it would be useful for us to come back at some point before finishing, and maybe it would be as a summary for both the stroke and AMI measures to talk about how it's going to be reported, and to think about the usability in that context. So why don't we move on to the next subcategory? So 2G is comparability of multiple data sources. That's been nicely outlined as part of the project in the comparison with the CMS and ARC data. So 2G, I gave a C. Disparities in care, that's not applicable specifically because the claims database is defined excluding such considerations. It's sort of a priori coming from the database that's been selected. Okay, so next, any other comments from the TAP members about the sub-criterion number two?
Nope.
Doesn't sound like it. Okay. So usability, meaningful, understandable, and useful information, 3A. I think that as reported with well-defined PACs, then I would give that a C. But I think it's important to understand what is actually being reported. So these are potentially avoidable complications and that it's linked to a primary diagnosis. I think there's room to argue about the usability based on how it's reported, but as defined, I think that it is understandable and meaningful, so I give that a C. 3B. Related to other NQF-endorsed measures.
I think the presentation is there for measures that are looking at the presenting diagnosis.
Right. So harmonization. The harmonization, I believe, is complete as long as we emphasize that, like other AMI and stroke measures, that this is based on the primary diagnosis. But I think we've already agreed that that will be clarified. So it's harmonized as well in terms of time, hospitalization, and then subsequent follow-up in 30 days, and that it's also harmonized with other definitions, both CMS and AHRQ. So 3B, I gave a C. Additive value, I think it has substantial additive value because it includes a population that is not necessarily included in the CMS measures or in the Medicare population. There, some of these have parallel descriptions in the ARC database, in the NIS database. So I gave 3C a C as well. Any other comments on usability from the TAP members?
No, not for me.
Okay, great. Thank you. So moving on to the last sub-criterion, feasibility, I gave 4A, 4B, 4C, and 4D, and 4E all C. I originally did not, but now that I understand the exclusions, I believe that the population is well circumscribed, the claims data have clear sources, and I don't have any question about that. So I gave that all five of those a C.
Ted, this is Reva. I just wanted to make a comment addressing Dr. Sadawi's comments at the beginning about, availability of the various pieces of data, because these come from various different claim streams.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and it's been mentioned in some of the other TAPs and discussions of similar measures, that these really would not be something that a hospital or a provider level could pull the data together. This is really put together by the folks who have access to those multiple streams of claims data. And in fact, the project I did last year was looking at more sophisticated performance measures based on multiple streams of claims data, as well as even adding in other electronic data, such as lab values or things like that. Mm-hmm. So there is an evolution towards these merging of various electronic, including claims, as sort of a transitional stage as we ultimately move over to all electronic data collection through EHRs, et cetera.
Right. So, I think that's a very valuable point, because even moderate and large-size medical systems often have difficulty in looking at the longitudinal episode of care for both hospitalization and outpatients, because they come in so many different data streams. So this actually does have quite a lot of potential, and I can see why large systems would find this very useful, because the data would be comparable from one institution to another, and you would learn more about opportunities for improvement.
And a question I would ask just on that, because I'm anticipating the steering committee, Francois, is even though you've not had access to Medicare data, is there any reason to think that you couldn't apply the methodology to the Medicare database and have it be able to generate useful information?
With respect to acute medical events like MI, stroke, and pneumonia, I think the answer is you can use the Medicare data to arrive at the measurement. So I don't think there's any impediment to doing it, but you do have to have access to full Part A and Part B. Part D is less important, although has some significance, and that is the one thing that worries me about application in Medicare is the lack of current integration of A, B, and D. And up until a few weeks ago, the D donut hole, which also creates some issues in terms of full data collection. But with those caveats, the counting the claims and splitting them between the categories can be done in commercial or Medicare data streams, and we're currently experimenting with, looking at the similar results in a Medicaid data stream, although again, for the purposes of this submission, we're limiting it to commercial populations.
Hi, this is Tony Sidawi again. Let me ask this question. Maybe I missed it while reading the description of the measures, but how are you going to pick up on mortality, except if we're not going to consider mortality as a complication? I mean, let me give you this scenario. A patient gets an MI, leaves the hospital, get an arrhythmia, and then dies outside the hospital. How that patient complication is going to be captured?
Well, 30-day mortality is already a measure that's being captured elsewhere, so we excluded mortality as because it's the ultimate complication. So our focus has been on rehospitalizations, readmissions, emergency department visits, and events that occur during the hospitalization, as opposed to mortality, which again, either inpatient during the stay or post discharge, is being captured elsewhere.
Except, as I said, it could be a complication directly related to the MI that leads into mortality, and if you don't pick up mortality, you're not going to pick up that complication, such as arrhythmia. Patient leaves the hospital, goes right into arrhythmia. That's a complication. And if you don't pick up mortality through this measure, you're going to pick up that complication. You're going to miss that complication.
That's correct. So we would miss that. Again, my impression, although I'm not an expert on all measures that exist, I was under the impression that mortality post-discharge for MI is an existing measure.
But I'm not talking only about mortality. I'm talking about a complication that's going to lead to mortality, and once the patient dies,
following up on your example, let's say that the patient is discharged after having an MI, mm-hmm. And then has a series of so it doesn't die immediately, but has arrhythmia, has a series of visits to cardiologists for the arrhythmia post-discharge, that would, in fact, get picked up. So those services would get picked up as avoidable complications. The death of the patient gets picked up in the mortality.
Okay. All right.
Very good. Are there any other comments about this measure before we move on to the stroke measure? And then I think the combination will lead to some questions about their utility and perhaps broader questions about the reporting.
This is Rich Prager. I just have, and I don't want to broaden the discussion. I'm actually intrigued by this type of approach and separating it into the categories, including patient safety failures. What I struggle with a little bit, but realize it's out of our purview, is using definitions of complications from CMS, perhaps, such as in cardiac surgery, we have a specific one, mediastinitis. Understanding, Francois, this is, we're not trying to get to zero defects. Those types of terminology, never events and zero defects, sometimes get blurred. And should this ever become, which it may well, unrelated to the measure developer, but a star rating, if you will, ranking system, we have perpetuated what has been decided as a complication into that. And I have a little reservation about that, not necessarily about the system, but that we're buying into something that we have embedded.
About its potential use, and as you know, there's a drift on hospital-acquired conditions that's moving in the same direction.
Right.
There's a drift on patient safety indicators from ARC that's moving in the same direction. And we've been, I think, very careful, at least in our work, to counter that drift by being as clear as we can in saying that, you know, these are potentially avoidable complications, hence my emphasis on the terminology. It's you're right. I mean, this is something that actually keeps us up at night. We've had lengthy discussions with originally with the members of our design team, with the clinical advisory groups, and some of your colleagues have helped us along the way quite extensively on our work. And its use of measures is always a concern, which is why in our definition, and I know we're going to get to this, but in our recommendations around use, we're trying to be as prescriptive as we can in saying that, yes, it can be used for accountability purposes under certain circumstances. But my sense, by the way, is that because of the lumpiness, the idea that this long list, because these are long lists of potentially avoidable complications, would all universally drift towards a definition of zero defects, I think is actually highly unlikely. What becomes more likely is when you parse these out into individual events, and then you can look at some of these individually and say, well, should this be a never event or should this not be a never event? I actually think that by lumping them together and collecting them as a whole under a definition of a total complication, a care measure as a composite for all these potentially avoidable complications, the notion or the supposition from anyone that you're going to get this down to zero, my sense is, you know, flies in the face of reality. So while the potential for someone to hold it up and say we ought to have zero potentially avoidable complications, I think first of all is you've got a problem if you say you need zero potentially avoidable complications because the terminology is inconsistent. But secondly, I just don't know that it would stand to any kind of reasonableness test. So we've in the discussions that we've had in the field, I think that's what's helped us mostly, is that by taking all of this together and looking at it rather holistically, we very rapidly get over the point that you're not going to get to zero. So the question is, what do you need to tackle on? Where are the points of similarity in PACs incurred for MIs and stroke and pneumonia you know, potentially other procedures that as an organization you might look at and say, okay, this is where I need to focus my quality improvement on in order to reduce my PACs overall. So I know I'm not answering your question in a way that would definitively say absolutely not, because there's always a potential for some crazy person out there to use something that you're doing for purposes not intended. I do think that someone who would do that would look rather silly.
I hope so.
Do we stick with the C for the electronic sources, or should that? I mean, it seems to me like there's few issues here related to collection of data regarding this measure.
What specifically are you suggesting, Dr. Sadawi?
Well, I mean, we said that C for complete, right, data collection regarding this measure, but there are some issues that we discussed, myself and others, that may make that complete may not be that complete while collecting data for this particular measure.
If we're looking at it from the perspective of it has, you know, it, the measure can only be calculated by folks who have access to claims data, and that's not going to be at the provider level to be able to merge these, then what specifically are you referring to?
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is there are some concerns about the completeness of data regarding this particular measure. I mentioned the situation of somebody having a complication and dying without making it to the surgeon, so a complication is not going to be picked up. We just heard about another concern, and I'm saying, should we then say that the collection of data electronically may not be as complete as we thought it was, and therefore we should change the labeling for that particular item?
Just to clarify, when we're using the term complete, we're using that to completely meet the criteria, which is not whether the data collection is a complete one. All right, so let me just scroll down and find it on the data.
Right, so I think you're right, Dr. Sadawi, that a combination of data sources beyond the data sources that are available through claims data ultimately give you the complete picture that anyone would want. In our submission, I think by acknowledging that we are looking at solely looking at claims data streams, we're limiting, by definition, the measure to what we can collect and measure through that data stream.
Okay.
Right. So I think you're right in your point that we're not capturing everything, but in our submission we're acknowledging that we're only capturing what can be captured using the sole data stream that we're using.
Okay.
But I think your comments about what patient populations or events are not captured are an important thing to make very clear in your evaluation, and I'll do that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
In other measures have actually come up with percentages of total population subject to a given complication of only about 60 to 70%. So I think that if we look at the likelihood that someone would have a complication resulting in sudden death that is not met by some form of claims data is probably going to be less than 20% of the population looked at. I agree it's a shortfall, but I think that the total value of the data is still going to be substantial.
That is correct, but we're talking about MI here, and patients who have MI actually do have sudden death. So, if we're looking at something different, such, mm-hmm. you know, maybe appendicitis patients or something not related to the heart, and they get the sudden death in those patients is so little, especially because of their age and because of the disease, if not their cardiac disease. But we're looking at patients who already had an acute MI. So the incidence of sudden death in these patients is pretty sizable. This is why I'm making that comment. But that's fine, as long as everybody agrees to what's been said and labeled, that's fine with me.
Okay, any other comments about the AMI measure? I think it's probably time to move on to the stroke measure.
Did Dr. Katzen join us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, great, Irene, super. Because she sent in her initial ratings, and that's what's up on the webinar.
Hey, this is Dr. Spindler. I have to go. My good time to check out. Okay.
Thanks,
sorry.
So the stroke measure is, of course, very similar to the AMI measure, and so a lot of the what has been discussed will be very much repeat. I guess overall, my general impression of this measure was a little bit more cautious than has been previously discussed. And so a lot of my responses are couched in partially complete rather than complete. For the first portion of this, importance to measure and report, going down here, I thought the importance of complications are very well addressed. They're very well outlined. I thought that that was a complete opportunities for improvement. I thought that I actually gave it a partially complete. I do think that we know that we could always improve on secondary prevention. We can always improve on process measures. I think that we had the data on the connection between adequate compliance with process measures and secondary prevention and that kind of stuff is not as strong as we'd like between process measures and actually outcomes or complications. And perhaps for that reason, I gave it a partial. I also I was happy to hear the discussion about how this measure would be viewed, and the fact that complications can't be entirely prevented, even the ones that have been couched to be potentially avoidable. I mean, there's some comments in here about a well-managed patient with stroke should rarely incur a potentially avoidable complication such as an emergency room visit. I totally disagree with that.
Yes.
The stroke neurologist, we can't help some of the stuff that happens. They're sick people. So that actually, I think, framed my attitude towards some of these measures, these comments about how it should rarely incur. I think in general, I don't agree with. I think coma and somebody who's got a brainstem stroke, boy, my goodness, you can't avoid that. Coma in general in somebody with a stroke, you can't avoid. So I actually have some concerns about that. And so the way that the rate of potentially avoidable complications would be approached and perhaps dividing them amongst different things when people are making assessments would be important. So for one, where did we leave off? So 1C relationship to outcomes, I gave it a partially completed. And then the next following one, I think, goes down to, well, that's it. And so my comments overall in this section are what basically have been said, that I'm not sure that all of the potentially avoidable complications that are listed are avoided. I think in some cases there are some of these potentially avoidable complications that can rarely be avoided. So that makes me leery about using this measure and has to be used with care. Regarding the science, and I don't know how other people feel about this. I know that that wasn't a concern at all that was raised with the AMI measure. Regarding the scientific acceptability of the measurement properties, I gave that a P. And I think in large part it was due to the same types of issues related to identification of what is considered a complication or not, specifically some of the neurological ones. I agreed with the denominator exclusions. I believe that excluding the or including only patients 18 to 65 actually for stroke, the fact that the majority of patients are greater than 65, if we only include the 18 to 65-year-olds, we will be excluding a large proportion of stroke patients. And that's actually something to consider when we talk about this measure.
Excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt you, but was that done so we don't have to deal with Medicare data? Is that what it is?
Well, it's because we do not have access to Medicare data, certainly not the combination of A, B, and D. And so as a result of which, the analyses and all the calculations of this measure was done on commercially insured populations.
Correct.
And I think the difficulty for many in technical advisory panels, and not just this one, but the prior ones we've talked to, is that in your day jobs, the majority of the patients that you are seeing are patients over the age of 65 in Medicare. And so I think part of our part of the optics is always skewed towards the post-65 population, and our definitions and supporting documentation is for the under-65 population. And so I think some of the comments in addition in the submission, while I agree with you, Doctor, about the propensity to avoid some of these, there is many times a difference in the ability to avoid some of these complications for patients under the age of 65 than for those over the age of 65.
And that may be the case. I guess the ones I'm thinking of don't really have an age demarcation. But you're right. And one of the other big, and I always think this is important when we're trying to look at complications and outcomes, is the goals of care. I mean, in these older patients, the goals of care may be to let them go and not treat them aggressively. And so if one were to try to expand this to the greater than 65 population, we might run into problems with what is the appropriate goal of care and what are we actually trying to do for the patient, for these older ones, which where the family does not want aggressive care.
Right, and you've got end-of-life issues, which
end
are very different.
Yeah.
I agree, which is why, you know, we chose the population that we're
right.
focusing on.
Right, yes. Although, yeah, again, we're focusing on a minority of the we'd be dealing only with a minority of stroke patients.
I'm not a neurologist, but wouldn't be the cause of the stroke different also when you in the younger population than the older population? I mean, stroke is a symptom, obviously, of a disease, whether it's occlusion of the, whether it's embolic occlusion of the cerebral arteries, or
right.
it's a hemorrhage or whatever it is. Would that percentage changes, and would that make any difference on the results and the percentages that we're going to be shooting for?
Oh, I mean, I think it might. So, for instance, you know, younger people who have who have a stroke. Could develop coma because of the mass effect produced, and they don't have brain atrophy. So, I mean, there's three patients on service right now that actually are going down because of mass effect. I can't stop it as a neurologist, but I would be coded as having as my patient having a complication because the guy has had a big stroke and he's had a coma. He's in a coma, or he's stuporous because he's young.
So I
do think that, you know, this rate or this proportion of preventable, potentially avoidable complications, I mean, I really think that people have to be very careful at how it's used. And they have to use it almost as an exploratory thing rather than something that actually is used to judge people or judge health systems. Because I think we're mixing a lot of things together.
But as it was said before, once a measure is out there and endorsed by NQF, It's very difficult to control how people use it.
Yes, yes, and I agree. And actually, just the way that it's actually outlined on this thing made me be very concerned about it. I'm a little bit less concerned when I heard somebody talk about it, but you're right. Once this thing is released,
And I hear you about this, and I'll make just, this is Francois, two comments. One, when you look at least in the data that we supplied, the incidence of comas as PACs in either index stays or readmissions is incredibly small relative to the total number of PACs. So while I agree with you that it might be a line item that to an extent we should take out, on the flip side, if that's the last problem you deal with because the ability to significantly reduce it is relatively slim, that's going to get you to an incredibly low rate of potentially avoidable complications. I'm not trying to make light of it, but I do think that that's one of the reasons why we're not specifically parsing any of these out and taking them out as individual indicators and saying, woe is you because you've got six comas. No. The issue is there are 38 potentially avoidable complications associated to skin wound and other infections, which is something that, to a large extent, is highly controllable within during hospitalization. So, to the extent they're not present on admission. So, if I'm in charge of the hospital and trying to decrease rates of potentially avoidable complications, I'm going to start with the 38 because I have an ability to control them, as opposed to the six where I might have less. So, that being said, yes, you are right. That the way measures are used is uncontrollable. That's not just the way ours are used. I mean, think about the mortality rate measures or other measures that have been endorsed, hospital-acquired conditions, and others. And I think, you know, part of the pitch that we've been trying to make is, if it's sound and it helps improve quality of care overall, then that's the objective. And if there's concern about how it's going to be used, that's natural because any kind of measure that creates accountability in the system is going to entail some nervousness.
I understand. Your points are well taken. I guess from my standpoint, I'm still not getting the connection between why don't you focus on the measures that actually have a high degree of the high potential for being avoided. Do focus groups or something like that demonstrates which of these variables have the high potential to be avoided, like skin breakdown and that kind of stuff, rather than there's like a huge smorgasbord of different things.
Because we're trying to look at it from the patient's eyes, not the provider's eyes. And from the patient's eyes, all of these are bad things. And so from that perspective, yes, it is a smorgasbord, but it's the smorgasbord that patients eat at every day or get.
You're reporting this as like a report card to the hospitals, though. So,
but,
I mean,
but what we're reporting back to the hospital is the detail that you have here.
Right.
That's not what gets reported out in any form of public accountability.
You cannot say that. I'm sorry about this. Anything you report is in the public domain. Whether you report it to a hospital or you report it to any private group.
Well, but that's simply not true. I live in the state of Connecticut where there have been reports from hospitals to the Hospital Association for a decade, and none of them have seen the light of day.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of us have little concern with the data collected, and we have concern also with what you're stating. I mean, for you to say that this is not going to be publicly known or reported, I mean, might as well not say it. This happens all over the place.
Okay, so what if it is? Right.
Then we're going to start underreporting.
This to me, and I don't want to. We started on a high note. I don't want to leave it from that high note. The purpose of accountability is to shed light on what is going on today in the healthcare system, and from that light, not to shy away from it. But to embrace it in a way that then creates opportunities for improvement for everyone along the continuum. And there is fantastic nervousness about these measures from, I would say, pretty much everyone. But post-health reform, if you look at the amount of payment reform activities that are going to hit the delivery system, in particular hospitals, over the next several years, including episode of care payment that includes readmissions, hospitals are going and attending physicians and in the post-acute settings are going to clamor for these data as a way to avoid going bankrupt because they're no longer going to be paid for the defects that today are being reimbursed. So we can sit here and argue about the benefits of accountability, but the bottom line is that accountability is what creates improvement.
But let me tell you something. I mean, you're talking to a person who actually tried to put and pass through the NQF a performance measure for stroke and death after carotid and arterectomy to be at a very low level. So the issue is not nervousness. Okay, I mean, maybe some people are nervous, but this is not what we're dealing with here in such a committee or such a group working on things. What we're dealing with here is whether there is an evidence-based to what we're working on, what we're putting out there. I mean, that is very important.
Sure.
When the evidence on some of the things we're going to be looking at is soft, or the evidence is not there that you can improve on them, this is when we are having the argument. We're not having the argument because some people are getting nervous. I mean, that's not the issue. Please.
Well, so let me ask the question about the comas. Is any patient that gets admitted with a stroke that has a coma, is that always unavoidable?
Almost always unavoidable.
Almost always. But my question is it always unavoidable?
I suppose somebody can do something bad and actually put them in a coma, but that's very rare. And the vast majority of the times, it's unavoidable. So reporting that as a potentially avoidable complication, I just think, it just muddies things in my head. I just...
So let's say that we take that one out.
Okay. I actually would be more comfortable if things that are the vast majority of the time are of no fault to the physician but are just a marker of the severity of the impairment. I actually think that would help. And then actually having
What I can tell you is that the more we thin these out, they no longer fall into the realm of potentially avoidable.
Well, of course they will. They're not all complications, even urinary tract infections, are not always avoidable. They can be reduced, but not everything is avoidable.
So this is a great example. Urinary tract infections, not always available, but can be reduced. That should stay there. Developing skin lesion, ulcerations, that is hugely avoidable.
Right.
Definitely should be there.
Right.
So there are some issues that need to be there, and there's some issues that are not there.
No, and I think that's great feedback. And so for us and from you on the technical advisory panel, I think if you come back with, look, generally speaking, or more than generally speaking, there's the all the list of all of these potentially avoidable complications, at least for stroke, coma is one where the ability to compress is close to none and therefore should not be considered a potentially avoidable complication, that it's not a big deal for us to take it out.
Yeah, and I think that it might be beneficial to review each of them. There's many of them on the list. And I'm actually trying to think, of the patients with MI that I see. How many actually were avoidable? How many could we have prevented? The guys with MI come in, they're bad protoplasm. They have high comorbid conditions. Could I have actually avoided the MI in any way? The stress.
Well, we're not suggesting the MI is avoidable. It's what happens during the hospitalization of the MI and post.
No, for stroke, an MI is a
potential. Oh, I'm sorry, for stroke, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm just going through just some of the lists. I didn't go through each of them, but I would say that there are several that I would be more comfortable if they were removed. It would make me feel better about the measure that could be reported.
Would you feel better? This is Rich Prager. Would you feel better if we changed the word from complication? I know that's going to disrupt the rest of the world, but I think one of the things we're really saying as physicians who deal with patients is that it's an occurrence and an event, Now, maybe in the patient's eyes, and we are responsible and accountable, maybe in the patient's family's eyes and the patient's eyes, it's a complication. But what I'm hearing is some of these things are events or part of what happens with a complex hospitalization.
Exactly. Yeah. And so maybe if it's reworded to just complications, that would be better. But yeah, many things are actually more commonly associated with, and perhaps often the vast majority of the time, it's part of the complex patient rather
so
than...
But I would also champion a little bit the developer's perspective that if you're from a state that has public reporting, for example, already for cardiac surgical outcomes, what happened after the first year or two is people didn't worry about it and things did improve. We do have a role in keeping this robust so we can see what we're not doing as well. That we do have that role too.
But the problem with the robustness here, that there's, to my understanding, there is no risk adjustment, right?
There is.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
But the risk adjustment is largely financially based. I think there's a cost based. The cost of these.
Well, that's not what I meant. Obviously, I'm talking that there is no clinical risk adjustment. So if you go to an institution that's an inner city hospital, where you get a lot of people who are sick, bad protoplasm, by definition, the complications or quote unquote event in this population is going to be higher. And since you don't have clinical risk adjustment, how are you going to compare across the board? I mean, what does it mean for someone to have an MI of 3% after a stroke and another hospital to have 10%, for example? Now, don't worry about the actual numbers. But when you don't have clinical adjustment, this becomes even more problematic than if you do.
Yeah, so I, and the others can answer better, but there is a risk adjustment model that's in there that uses a mix of medications administered, I think, and procedures that are done, as well as comorbid conditions.
Age, gender, comorbid conditions, so they are clinically based.
But
in addition to that, as I indicated earlier, the indication of some of these conditions as present on admission would create a denominator and numerator exclusion.
Yeah, but I'll tell you that severity of impairment from the stroke is a huge driver of complications, and that's not on there. It's not a perfect thing.
Right, and as I understand, and I think we said this earlier, because my sense is severity of impairment of the patient upon admission with stroke is something that's not captured in the claim stream. So yeah, there are limitations to what can be done and measured using claims. However, you can count events such as these. And in all of our work, we've been very clear that the extent to which any of these items represent close to completely unavoidable complications, we simply won't put them in there. I mean, we have fairly extensively reviewed these with clinicians in the field, but that doesn't mean that it's always beneficial to have another pair of eyes look at them. And as I said, if one or two of these line items really jumps out as being, there's no way we're ever going to be able to compress these, that's fine. Because I'm looking at the bottom line here, and there's 453 potentially avoidable complications in this database for index days of stroke. If you want us to take out the six for the coma, it's not going to make much of a difference on the percentage.
Well, what I guess I'm suggesting is that each of the 453, which are a whopping amount, be reviewed and actually see whether or not that it actually is, it's...
Right, and I guess my response to that has been they have been reviewed.
I guess this is Ted Gibbons. I guess one of the things that occurs to me is that the title and the phraseology has a significant emotional impact, because it's referred to as an avoidable complication, which carries some moral weight. So I guess it would be worth at least thinking about the phraseology and how it's presented in terms of the actual nomenclature. But the other thing is that I get the sense as well that that different clinicians would interpret a potentially avoidable complication as having different weight depending on its impact on the patient. And I don't see any leeway to interpret one DAC being more important than another. And I understand the rationale for that, but I think it also creates an unsettled feeling.
So in quality improvement, and I agree with you, and if we started to weight them, then something like a coma, which has significant ramifications right. on a patient, might get a high weight when, in fact, the potential for reducing those might be relatively low. And what's interesting is that in all of the data that we've looked at around these complications of care, the ones with the highest frequency are often the ones that clinicians look at and say, wow, these are the ones that, we feel pretty confident could be reduced significantly. So if again, you get a global rate that says, out of 1,000 hospitalizations for MI or for stroke, we've counted 200 that had one or more line items with potentially avoidable complications, and here's the list, the ones that are going to any quality improvement officer within the institution or the accountable care organization is going to take the frequency list and start working it. And that's why we did not denominate the PACs this effort and this endorsement in dollar terms, because you would get a very different emphasis in dollar terms, nor create clinical weight on the PAC itself, because the purpose of quality improvement is to look at frequency of events and to try to drive them down. And if we were to drive the 200 down to 50, and what's left of the 50 are things that, as you indicate, are relatively complicated to reduce, or in some instances not reducible by any measurable way, then fine. We've reached what we call in quality improvement the rate of entitlement of that particular measure, in much the same way as has been for other measures that have reached essentially their entitlement by getting to points of compliance that are so high that it doesn't make any sense to focus on them anymore. And that is our approach. So, right or wrong, it's counting frequency as opposed to counting dollars or making clinical judgments about the specific weight of one over the other.
No, I agree with that. In fact, I agree entirely that once I looked at the list of complications and their frequency, it made a whole lot more sense about how it could be made practical in terms of a quality improvement. In fact, the 1 out of 5 episodes of hypo or hyperglycemia matches exactly the ICU review of complications in critical care. So
a great measure.
Yeah.
That's a nice potentially avoidable complication that should be included. But there are some that are tough. And so would it be possible to put them in two categories? Maybe you can keep off 453 of them, but then actually have some of them that have a higher probability of being avoidable?
Okay, so yes, as time goes on and as the measurement becomes more prevalent, I think we will see exactly those types of categorizations. At this point, and I think that one of the questions earlier was to provide data that shows the variation in results of potentially avoidable complications by state. Within states and between institutions, as you can imagine, there's also a fair amount of variation. And so part of, I think, the overall desire and our objective in doing this is let's understand the extent to which these are potentially avoidable and what experience teaches us in different institutions about their ability to be compressed. Things such as surgical site infections and others have been measured for a long time, and yet we don't seem to be making a huge amount of progress in reducing them. I don't think it's a surprise that hypo or hyperglycemia is an avoidable complication on many patients that get hospitalized. And it's not just strokes and MIs. We see it in patients hospitalized for pneumonia or even for other chronic conditions. And yet it's still a relatively high number and doesn't seem to be a whole lot of progress around it. So I agree with you that at some point one would hope that there does become a categorization in which you end up really with a bifurcation. One is, we've reached a level, or we do know that some of these events cannot be compressed by more than a fraction. Others can be compressed by, multiple percentages and deciles of percentages. I'm not sure we have the answer to that.
Yeah. So I'm actually wondering, because this is put forward as a quote a quality measure, at least that's how it's going to be perceived. And and as you say, and it's actually mentioned in there that, exploring the causality of these potentially avoidable complications is very important and has the possibility of improving outcomes of care. Totally agree with that. But perhaps until we have more data on the causality and we explore this, perhaps it shouldn't be risen to the level of a quality measure that's nationally adopted. Perhaps this is actually something that is something that's used by hospital systems to improve their quality of care, but it's not considered, quote, a measure that has that's actually very similar to the public reporting measure of beta blocker use after an MI or another measure of 30-day mortality, for instance.
Right. Well, so the dilemma, of course, payer, employer, consumer side is, I think, a general acknowledgement that the extent to that what doesn't get measured doesn't get improved. And so the extent to which you have a measure that isn't a quality measure that becomes one for accountability, the likelihood, again, given the fact that some of these have actually been around for a while and haven't improved much, the likelihood that a measure that ends up by being a nice to have for some internal QI problem actually has an effect is unlikely. So yeah, I mean we're going in this, and we have gone into this process, understanding full well that we're fighting an uphill battle. But until you start measuring it and holding the system, because that's really what this is. This isn't about individual clinicians or the hospital versus the people on the outside. It really is a system measure. So the extent to which we start measuring the system and understanding and counting frequency of events, then it's just not likely that we're going to see system improvement.
Okay. And I know we've talked a lot about it, and I'm happy to move on. I just, as you said yourself, there's this concern about, as you say, holding systems accountable for things that they have no control over. There's just like this uneasiness that will be there, and I have this uneasiness. If you hold my hospital system accountable for things that they have no control over, there's something makes me uneasy. I don't know where we are. I think we stopped at 9. We were going down to risk adjustment, and we mentioned it during the discussion.
Talked about risk adjustment. So the next one I think is, and then you were talking about meaningful differences, and I think that was sort of where you were talking.
I got off the
2F was meaningful differences, and I think that's where we.
Okay. 2F. Okay. And just one of the comments, I think we might have skipped over reliability and validity. The validity, I know a lot is said about how this has actually garnered the support of, and it has passed at least the validity test of a lot of the researchers, these 453 elements. Because I'm looking at some of them and I'm surprised, it would probably be good as this moves forward to have more specific data on who were these people and it was had the the response was positive, but what did that mean? And did you do focus groups? Was the initial measure set like 600, and you made it smaller to 453 by reducing things that people didn't feel relevant? I mean, that kind of a information would make people feel a little bit more comfortable about the group that was finally ended up in this measure set.
Very good point.
So for validity testing, I actually thought that just saying that everybody thought it was positive is not enough for me, especially since I disagree. I need more information about who tested it. It was a bunch of administrators. That makes a big difference than if it was a bunch of stroke neurologists on the ground or clinicians on the ground that are reviewing the AMI or the stroke measures. So for C, I gave that, to C, I gave that an M for needing some additional information. Regarding exclusions justified, looks like I did not answer that. I thought that was fairly complete, though. And then we did go to the risk adjustment. Sorry about that. And for risk adjustment, yeah, 2E, sorry, risk adjustment for outcomes. And I guess the only my only question with this is I'm not sure how that risk adjustment model is used when reporting the results. It looks like the results are reported as a proportion. I'm actually not sure in my head how that proportion is altered by the risk adjustment model that goes with it. Going down to 2F, identification of meaningful differences in performance, I think it explains why, explains how one would interpret differences in performance, but I'm not sure whether there has been a lot of information on whether or not these differences exist. I thought that more work could be done on that section. 2G and 2H, I don't think were applicable. So my comments are basically discussed in the preceding section. There's, I see that I made a comment. On the data sources section, somewhere it said that data could come from electronic medical record, and I'm not sure whether uniform data can come from electronic medical records, which are very heterogeneous right now and have various levels of completeness. So I worry about that. I don't think that's a great idea starting off. So moving down to the usability, I actually gave that a P, and in part I think it's a really interesting way to actually use this for hospital systems, not have any one single party accountable. I also actually have some issues, again, with how that risk adjustment model would be put into the mix. And it might not. It might just be because I didn't understand how it was described. So I gave that a P, I think. For 3B harmonization, I thought that was very nicely outlined. And for 3C, distinctive value was completely covered. And then finally, under feasibility. I guess I, maybe the electronic sources are right here. I guess if we're going to be comparing hospital systems and health systems, actually having the claims-based data being collected in a uniform manner will be important. And I wasn't sure how that was going to take place. Probably that 4A should be higher, maybe a P in my estimation. I don't know how others feel. 4B, I don't quite understand that. I would say that that's an M, and 4C I thought was fine.
the 4B is just whether the data is available electronically, and claims-based measures are.
Okay. All right. Sorry about that. Exclusions, I thought, was fine. I would give 4C a, let's see. The identification of potential inaccuracies was discussed. I gave that a C under 4D. And the data collection strategy as outlined here, actually, I thought was completely covered. So I guess the only other caveat I would say at the end of all this is I worry that if this is actually going to be something that people are going to be held accountable, that there will be risks of changing the way that information is coded. And that actually will have to be something that will be kept in mind.
Absolutely.
Does anybody have any other thoughts on the stroke measure?
I still think that the perspective that that this is a measure that has the potential to give us information about care from transition from hospitalization to the outside the hospital is a worthy measure, and that is going to give us information that's previously not available, just as Reva has said. So I think to the extent that that will inform some of our decisions about quality improvement, it's a valuable measure. But I think that from what I'm listening to about the stroke measure, that there seems to be more controversy in the way that has the potential for interpretation compared to that of MI in young patients. Could I ask one question, Francois?
You bet.
When you... it says that even in the measure development that you had either a focus group or had some vetting of this process with Partners Health System in Boston, Johns Hopkins in Geisinger in Pennsylvania. Have any of those actually adopted this methodology in order to provide quality improvement measures?
Well, Partners is in process of implementing the full Prometheus model internally as an organization. So, yeah, they're actually running claims data from three plans through the programs in order to look at and start creating quality improvement around their potentially avoidable complications and costs of episodes. Geisinger has done similar, so they run all of their internal claims through these definitions in order to start looking at and counting avoidable complications, and actually we now have other organizations as well. And I think everyone, I don't want to sound bad saying this, but part of what makes me comfortable about the measure, personally, is the fact that there is nervousness about it. And I think for all of us who have been in quality measurement, you know, there are measures that we see and say it's a no-brainer, and then there are measures that we see and say directionally it's good and makes me nervous. And when we went into this, and we had lots of conversations with the NQF and some of the members of the steering committee about the process of endorsement and the reasonableness of going for endorsement on these measures, there was an upfront acknowledgement that yes, there is, and there's nervousness from the people who are using it. Because I do think that it stretches the boundaries of what and where accountability are usually defined. But where it is being used, I also think, and it's more than I think, what we're seeing is an acceptance of the understanding of the purpose for the measurement and its ability to help guide quality improvement within the organizations. So It does take a while for to gain both familiarity and comfort, but I do think that does happen as the institutions both get the feedback and then start linking the claims feedback back to their internal medical record data and start understanding, again, some of the causality between what's being counted on the back end and what's happening within the institution.
Uh-huh.
Well, so, I mean, since everyone has been frank on this call, which I like it to be. I mean, look, always when a measure coming from the payer's point of view, the measure is suspect in the mind of providers and probably vice versa. So, I mean, I think part of it is that reason. But I think if we're all looking at the measure itself and its scientific backing, and whether the measure, as we've done all along when we looked at, and this is not the first time I am on a tab for NQF, and if we look at evidence-based measures and stuff like that, I think then everybody usually is happy because we're using actually scientific data. So, I mean, I guess this is part of the nervousness, but I don't think the nervousness is related to that we always are, physicians are always nervous when we're coming up with measures that look at their results. I think physicians are nervous when there are measures put together that they do not feel they're scientifically constructed and appropriately obtained and calculated. I think this is when people get nervous.
Well, if I might maybe expand on that a little bit, which is, In this instance, if you take the individual elements, I don't think there's any doubt about their scientific validity or the way they're being measured. I do think that it is the breadth that creates that effect, because when you look at an instance of a hospitalization and you have an understanding of what and how you can manage a patient within the confines of the institution, then what happens post-discharge and how accountability works across the system, and the breadth of the things, not just linked to the original index condition but potential comorbid conditions, does start creating, I think, that effect. So that because we've heard it from other TAPs, it gives also the sense of is this okay or is this not? Because as you pointed out, Doctor, earlier, kind of the smorgasbord effect gives you a sense of wow, it's not a homogeneous group of indicators. There's some heterogeneity in here, and yes, there is because of the breadth. So I do think that that's part of the effect.
Right. But you see, you said earlier that there are 450 or 451 outcomes in the database. You see, if you rank them or sort them by frequency, I would venture to say, and again, I'm not a neurologist, but I venture to say that you have there some complications that are very, very, very rare. Now, why are we looking at those complications? I mean, what is the statistical significance that we're going to be, that's going to be in comparing institutions of a complication that's 1 per 10,000 or 1 per 100,000 patient? I mean, I think this is where this effect comes through. I think if you came and said we have 450 possible complications, there are some that are very, very rare. We decided not to look at those that have a percentage rate below this. And then there are some that we really, no one can have a major impact on. Take those out, and we're ending up with this group of complications that actually we can make a dent in looking at them and providing the information to institution. I could tell you probably none of us on this call probably sat down and argued with you about them. But
right.
You did not. Well, you threw
no,
the kitchen sink,
right.
And this is what made everybody argue about it.
Right.
But it's not the nervousness. It's actually the reason behind it.
Okay, so our answer to that point, it's an important one. Our answer to that point is at two levels. The first is if you prejudge, then it's difficult to really test the boundaries of quality improvement because you're taking elements that today are felt as not being highly actionable, and you're setting them aside. And we decided not to do that. And you're right that because the frequencies are low, We know that for quality improvement and accountability purposes, the institutions are going to focus on the high-frequency one, but counting the low-frequency ones creates a level of awareness that you simply never have if you don't even count them. The second one is, although you're right that in some instances the frequencies are very low, and statistically it has absolutely no effect in comparison of one institution to the other, but that's not the point of the measurement. The point of the measurement is that it has an effect on the patient to whom it occurs. So even if...
this is really interesting. If a patient comes with stroke today to a hospital, a neurologist goes to speak with the family and tell them, you know what, patient had a stroke, this is what may happen with the patient, possible complication. Do you think any physician will cite 450 possible complications? Do you think any physician would even think about the 450th complication ranked by order of frequency? Do you think that the 450th complication makes any difference? It doesn't make any difference, really. I think this is the way you decided to do it for one reason or another, but not necessarily is the right way to do it, and that's what we're discussing now. I mean, to provide to a hospital a report with 450 possible complications, you know what the hospital is going to do? It's not going to look at the 450 complication. Either they're going to say, this is crazy, what are we looking at here? And or they're going to say, you know, we're going to focus on the top 10. But nobody is going to focus on the 450th complication. It's just nobody is.
No, not today, but the hope is that once you get past the first 10, you go move on to the next 10 and then beyond that, and counting is important.
All right.
Is there any other discussion for either the AMI or the stroke measures?
By the way, how many complications do you have for the AMI? Since I didn't hear the number, maybe that's also another 450.
I think there were more complications for MI.
Okay.
You know, anytime when I've been involved in QA discussions, when the institutions I've worked at have gotten reports from places like LeapFrog, we actually go through and say, why didn't we get 5 stars this year on some particular measure? And we actually look at all the cases that that caused a shortfall. So I think that what you look at is not so much the scorecard, but the avoidable issues that you can work on. So I don't think that it's necessarily the case that you're going to look at all 450, but you are going to look at the top 10 and then go on from there. So,
but the top 10 should actually have the potential to be avoidable.
Yes, exactly.
But and I would say, Doctor, that is going to be a decision that the institution is going to make, and every institution is going to likely make a slightly different decision based on both their clinical priorities and their determination of their potential to affect any one of these within their institution. And I suspect that the answer that you would give in your health system based on the competence of the folks internally would be far different than what might happen in another institution. And so your rate of an ability to reduce some of these numbers is going to take a shape and a pattern that's going to be very different than someone else's. And ultimately, as we learn from each other on how different systems can affect different parts of these frequencies, that's ultimately how, you know, overall we're gonna get better. And I know I'm preaching to the choir, but that's a fundamental tenet of quality improvement. It's just it's even with the LeapFrog reports, they're not the same for every organization, and the organizations react very differently to each one of them and take on different elements of quality improvement based on what they think they can tackle in their top 10.
Right. It's Reva. Ted, do you think we should go to public comment?
I think that would be great.
Yeah. Joel, are you still with us?
Yeah, but I don't have public comment according to these measures.
Okay.
I'm fine. I did have a quick question to ask you, though.
Which all right.
It's dealing with the health care reform legislation. In there, they say that all-cause readmission measures are inpatient only. Has NQF thought about that issue as related to the ones that are being discussed by the TAP?
No, not yet.
Okay.
A little too new. But thank you for bringing it up, and I'll see what we can do to at least begin to address it.
Thank you. That's it.
Doesn't make sense.
Is there any other public comment?
Anybody else? I think we're a small group today.
Yep. Okay.
So.
All right. Well, I think, Reva, if there's no other discussion, then I would say that we've accomplished our task.
Right. I'm going to be putting together the summary for you, and I'm going to be doing it very quickly, if not tonight, first thing tomorrow, so I'll be sending it out to you for your comments. I guess the one thing I would ask is for you to think about the ratings, because these measures are quite similar, though I think there are some very specific differences that you highlighted very well between AMI and stroke. But the question is, you know, rating the two measures on things where they're essentially the same, but rating them very differently, how is that going to play to an audience? And so I would ask you to kind of look at that in the draft summary and, you know, perhaps consider if that's the way you want to present it.
Well, they are similar, Reva, but actually they are two different diseases.
So I agree, and when the disease issues make them different, that's great. I'd like to make that very explicit, though.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I don't want to have either one of them, but if I have to have one of them, I'll probably have an MI and not a stroke. I mean,
you're right. No one's volunteering, but
I'm not volunteering. But I'm saying they are two different diseases.
That's fine. And if that explains the differences, that's great. I want to be sure I capture that so our audiences who read these will understand those differences as well.
Okay.
So just be sure I've conveyed that in the summary. Otherwise, I think if we're finished, I want to thank everybody for taking the time and looking at the measures and a lively discussion. And, Francois, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you to everyone. It's fantastic feedback.
Yeah. And also to the TAP members, you guys have really been the longest. You've hung in there through a couple of months of hard work. You've had the largest number of measures. This last group of measures is going to the steering committee in April. So just things are moving along. The measures that you talked about at your meeting in January have already gone to the steering committee. We're in the process of putting that together, and they will be released for public comment probably by the end of April. So things are moving along, and your role in it has been very important in getting us where we're going and keeping the momentum up. So I really do thank you all very, very much for your participation. I know it's been a considerable amount of time that you've put in, and we're very grateful for it.
And if I may say so, Francois, you've been excellent at defending your measure.
Thank you. I've had a little
and
bit
I'm
of practice.
For putting it together.
And who was there with you? I'm sorry, I didn't pick up the other name. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.